It's a Friday on Scoops with DannyMac.com, and that means the weekend is here. We're loaded with sports, and let's talk it over with Ben Fredrickson of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch and STLtoday.com. A lot of people on a Friday will always come to the website because they like to hear from Ben Fred. So good morning, Ben. How are things going with you?
Good morning, man. I'm doing well and grateful for the listeners. I love hearing from folks who are checking out the podcast. And whether they're putting their kids down for naps, I hear some that's a good nap, like good nap time podcast when they're putting the baby down or driving to work. So it's fun, man. Every Friday, good chance to look back at the week and good chance to look forward at the weekend.
Well, I'm going to take that in a couple of ways. I hope this isn't putting them to sleep.
No, they're not putting themselves to sleep.
They're
putting their kids to sleep.
Okay.
And then checking out the podcast.
Gotcha.
They're wired for Ben Fred Fridays.
Gotcha. Yeah. Some hot takes
coming their way. Coffee. Oh, just scorching. Yeah.
Got it. Okay. You wrote at STLtoday.com. I've been talking a lot about this because I'm fascinated by it. A 76-year-old guy that we know quite well. I think we want to see him back selfishly in the game in a different capacity, Tony La Russa. So you wrote about this potentially coming back, managing the Chicago White Sox. I want to see it happen. I'm not sure it's realistic. They're going to go through with this. They're going to interview him. I had Mike Schilt on the podcast yesterday. You can go to the website. I asked him at the very end. I said, hey, what do you think about it? He goes, hey, he's a big boy. Go for it. I said, good, let's get him in. I think it'd be great. What do you think about Tony realistically managing the Chicago White Sox?
I think it's one of those things where, first of all, I'm with you. I'd love to see it happen just because I think it's a great story and it would be fun to watch play out. But the more I think about it, the more sense it could make. And it's kind of one of those things that when I first saw the name, I go, oh, I don't know about that. You know, does he want to get back into doing that? And what do you – shouldn't they probably go with somebody who's younger? And then the more you think about it and the more you look at all the things that could fit, it really does start to make sense. And on both sides, one is start with the White Sox, right? They've got this loaded team full of young guys who need to figure out what they have to do to take it to the next level. They're no longer rebuilding. They're ready to contend. And they need a manager who's been there and done that, who can both hold players accountable, but also get the best out of players and help figure out who are the best guys to bring in around this young core. Tony is old school in a lot of ways, Dan, but as you know, as well as anyone, he's not old school in how he treats players. He has unique relationships with each player. He knows which guys need tough love. He knows which guys need an arm around their shoulder. That's not something that phases out. Like, if a guy knows how to do that, he knows how to do it. And he's not been, you know, away from the game. It's not like he's been golfing. He's been at more winter meetings than anybody in between, you know, the time he walked away from managing and not. He's been active in multiple front offices. He's got relationships with current players. Some of the young players that he was managing back in the you know, his time with the Cardinals are some of the guys who love him the most to this day. So he speaks that language. He knows analytics more than some people give him credit for. He was doing analytics before they had a name. And then the other thing I think is what's his motivation? And that's the big question, is why would he want to do this? Well, Tony loves stories, and, you know, he loves books. He loves movies. He loves the idea of a good story. And this would be a great story. He's managed three places. He's won championships at two of them. He didn't have as much success as he would have liked to with the White Sox, his first stop. He remembers those days as part of what made him the great manager that he became, but he didn't get to have that success there. He's remained friends with chairman there, Jerry Reinsdorf, who has called firing Tony La Russa a mistake. It would be kind of a full circle job. And I think that it would be good for both of them. I talked to Tony, the last time I talked to him was during what would have been opening week for baseball. And I said, hey, are you thinking about just retiring? And he, like, you know, politely scoffed, and he said, I've got too much to give to the game. As long as there's somebody who wants me to give something to baseball, then I'll give it. And he was so crazy after a month without baseball that I think it maybe reminded him how much he liked managing. So I don't think he's too old. I think he is very, very up to date with what's going on with the game. And I think he would command respect with that clubhouse. So I hope it happens. I think it's more realistic than some people are giving it credit. We'll see. I think they want to talk to AJ Hinch and everybody else. But I did talk to somebody who's been in the White Sox organization for a long time who said, look, this thing has some legs to it. It's not just people throwing names around. He has interviewed or at least met with the White Sox once about it, which I don't think he probably would have done unless he was interested in the job. So we'll see how it goes.
You know, I've been asked about this, and I said it's not like taking some guy off the couch from 10 years ago that hasn't been around the game. And that is the big difference, you know, in Arizona – running that franchise, then being with the Angels. And if you watched any of these games, and he's always in constant contact with members of the Cardinals, in particular, like Mike Schilt, he is in a owner's suite, or he's in a GM box, or a president of baseball operations, or with the Boston Red Sox. He's taking notes, and he's trying to do his due diligence with those two teams, and or those three teams, I should say, in his capacity and in those roles. So, you know, you're not just coming off the couch and saying, well, here I am, I'm going to try to do it what I was doing 10 years ago. The game is completely different than it was 10 years ago. So he's around the game. And as you mentioned, yeah, the players, they've changed a little bit, but he's been there with those changes. And in terms of just instant credibility, he walks in the clubhouse. In my mind, he's got it because he's got the resume. And when you shake his hand, he's got the rings, so he's got the credibility, and you're right. He knows when to kick a guy in a rear, and he knows when to put his arm around you. So I don't know, man. I think he could do this, and I think it's fascinating. I think it'd be great for the game.
Yeah, I think, too, that the motivation for him would be there. I mean, what a thing that would be for him to put the final chapter of his baseball career by leading the White Sox to a World Series. You know, he won them in Oakland. He won two in St. Louis. He won three between the two, but he only had one first place finish with the White Sox. He had one postseason appearance, didn't make it past the ALCS there, and it was a lopsided one. You know that, Bob, like, knowing Tony, you know that sticks with him. He can both enjoy the start that he had in Chicago, but know, you know, what it would mean to him to go back there and win big, and this is the team to do it. We got to mention, too, and this is huge, Cardinals fans will know, Dave Duncan is a pitching advisor with the White Sox. He's with the organization. And, you know, we know how Tony feels about Dunk and what their relationship was and how they were able to, you know, they're really co-pilots when it comes to managing a game. So the fact that he's already there, I think, makes things really, really interesting. You know, I don't think he's missed a beat when it comes to in-game management. And I think he's probably, if anything, more receptive now to that relationship a front office and manager has to have in this current modern age than he was when he was a full-time manager, because he's seen it from the other side. So I think it's an intriguing name. I mean, again, the more you think about it, the more sense it makes, especially when you factor in the fact that Tony knows a thing or two about stories and wanting to put his mark on things, to end things the way he wants to.
Yeah, it'd be really cool. I just think it's so interesting to see what kind of coaching staff he would assemble, a mix of youth and maybe the old school guy and the kind of guy that he would get. I'd really be curious to see what he would do, what direction he would go, and what he's been observing through the years of what kind of coach he may want. And maybe he goes against some of the guys that he's had in the past. You don't know. Or maybe he gets the band back together. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, it's like, that's what I said. Will we not all be simultaneously watching the Cardinals and also reading up on the White Sox if he was there? And I love that Schilty says, go for it, man. Schilty's just glad he's not in the same division, probably.
Because, exactly.
You know, they could that would go from, and they love each other. They really do have a great relationship. But I imagine they could get cross with each other pretty quick if they were managing against each other.
Wouldn't it
in the same division?
Hey, wouldn't it be weird in interleague play to see those two guys go like toe to toe and start screaming at each other? I'd be there for it though.
There could be some red ass between the two of them if they had to meet each other very often.
It'd be, you know, awesome.
I'll give Tony credit, and he really was one of the first to come out and say. And he had a good relationship with Mike Matheny. I don't want to make it seem like there was distaste between those two. But when Schilt got the job, Tony was one of the first guys to come out and say, hey, I know people don't know much about this guy, but you need to wake up. This guy knows what he's doing.
Absolutely.
And I think he was very outspoken in his support of Schilt. And I think that resonated with a lot of people. And they still talk. I mean, they, for folks who say, man, is Tony outdated? You know, Mike Schilt doesn't call Tony and say, hey, what, tell me what to do here. That's not how these guys talk to each other. But he does call him and say, hey, here's what the situation. Here's what I did. What do you think about that? What would you have done? And here's why. And, you know, they talk baseball. And Tony's talking baseball with guys who are still managing night in and night out. He never has stopped. So this idea that he was has been at the golf course or something, or doing only his ARF dinners for 10 years now, it's just not the truth.
Hey, the Gold Gloves, Ben, were determined, at least the finalist, yesterday, and it's done in a different fashion this year than in the past. Usually there's a vote by human beings, or at least a portion of that, and this year solely determined by numbers, and that's using Sabres defensive index. And Yadier Molina, not a finalist at catcher. The Cardinals do have three finalists: Tyler O'Neill, Colton Wong, Paul Goldschmidt. So no Yadi, so he's trying to get that 10th gold glove. What did you think?
Well, I think my guess here is that some of these players probably don't understand how it was selected this year. You know, you and I were actually talking about this before we started recording, just the selection process, and you can't do it the old school way, which is the way it normally works is you have a group of voters, and this is like the one award where people can't get mad at the writers. It's the managers and the players. So the writers have nothing to do with it, the writers or the broadcasters, but they send out the packets of the stats. Here's what the numbers say, but we also want you to use your eye test. You've played against these guys and managed against them. And it's their vote, but it's, they hope it's informed by the numbers. Well, this year, because there was no crossover play, they just decided to make it all about the numbers. And that's all there is to it. And in the numbers they selected, the defensive statistics they valued, that's how it shook out. Now, when you only go by those numbers, you're going to get some surprising things, like every NL Central catcher getting love except for Yadier Molina. You're going to get things like Tyler O'Neill being mentioned as a finalist, who I think was a very good defender, but I don't know that anybody says, if you ask 10 people, if they would tell you that they think Tyler O'Neill's a gold glove finalist in left field. Some of it with Yadi, it was the games played. You know, those things factor into those stats. He missed time due to COVID, and it was an incredibly short season. So I think that was going against him. He also had more, I think he had some kind of an uncharacteristic amount of pass balls this year. So if he has a better understanding of how that happened, maybe he doesn't get that upset response. But he was almost like he was upset about the voters, but there were no voters this year. It was just the numbers. So I hope they don't keep doing it this way, because I like that the players and the managers have a say in it. For this year, it was going to be hard to vote that way. So I really think this is a lot of noise about kind of nothing, to be honest. It's complaining about the voting process, or the selection process, I guess, is fine. But it's not like there's a person or people to get mad about.
Yeah, I think if you go solely on the numbers, and this is strictly numbers, you would understand it. FanGraphs defensive WAR, Molina ranked fifth in the National League among catchers. Defensive runs saved, he was seventh. Framing metrics, he was 13th. Led all National League catchers, he had five errors. He trailed the three finalists in fielding percentage. He allowed three pass balls, 5 for 11 in attempted stolen bases. Now, those are the numbers. Here are the facts, and I think you would agree with me on this, Ben. We watch him on a nightly basis. He controls a running game. He controls a pitching staff. He is a savant behind the plate defensively and understanding how a game is run. He's like a coach. I mean, it's cliche, but he is like a coach or a manager on the field. Mike Schilt in the podcast yesterday with me said he sees the game better than I do, and he said, I'm not overstating that. He said he sees the game better than I do. And he said, I don't mean disrespect to other managers. He sees the game better than they do, which is quite a statement from Mike Schilt. So when you start factoring in those things that don't show up as just black and white numbers, then you get a full understanding of what he means to the entirety of the game.
Well said. And you're not going to ever get a full appreciation of Yadier Molina based off of just the numbers, which kind of makes it a little odd that the Rawlings and the group that awards this thing decided to do it just based off the numbers in a season that was 60 games.
Right.
And all we're hearing about this year is how these numbers, we're not supposed to read too much into them. Now, sometimes I agree with that, sometimes I don't. But this would be one of those cases where it's hard for me to agree with some of the things the numbers are telling us wholeheartedly. 60 games is a very short amount of time in terms of valuing some of these numbers. But if the goal of the award this year is to reward those numbers, and that's exactly what they decided to do, then that's that. I can see how they made those. I mean, there was really no decision to make. You punch it into the computer, and that's your vote. That's who wins. That's kind of why, you know, I fear, like, this is a bigger picture, but Hall of Fame voting can at some point be argued in that way. Well, you punch all these numbers into an algorithm, and this guy's a Hall of Famer and this guy's not, and there's no wiggle room. Well, that's not, I don't have a vote yet, but that's not how I will vote. And I hope that's other people kind of include some other thoughts into that thing just besides the stats. I think you want to talk to people who played with the game, people who played against these players. And if that element was involved, then it usually is in the Gold Glove selection. I think you probably would have seen Yadier Molina be a finalist again. But the way they explained it, I get it. I wonder if some of the players who seem to be upset understand why things have changed this year.
World Series, it's been fun. This postseason, expanded playoffs, I've really enjoyed it. Now we're getting back to, I don't know if the word normalcy is right, because there's no, at least not a full stands, but we're seeing some fans in the stands, which has been interesting in itself. It's a great pitching matchup tonight. Walker Buehler for the Dodgers, Charlie Morton for the Rays. And in terms of the offense, I mean, the Dodgers, that lineup, it's deep, it's powerful. Man, is it patient. On the other side, the Rays, I was saying going into this, if the Dodgers win this series, it'll be their offense, which is really good, and they cannot pitch to Randy Arozarena, which they have not. He's walked three times. He's 1-for-6. And all they're doing is really attacking him with breaking balls. I was looking at some numbers with him, Ben. He's seen 29 pitches so far in the World Series. He's only seen 7 fastballs. The amazing number that I dug up with this, the Dodgers have sent 77 batters to the plate. They've got 5 home runs, 11 walks, and they've got 26 strikeouts. So more than half their plate appearances have resulted in a ball not being hit to a fielder. That's an incredible amount. So you understand how deep the Dodger lineup is, and you understand the importance of Randy Arozarena, and it sets up to have a really entertaining game number 3 tonight.
Yeah, I think the other huge element in this game are those Rays money relievers.
No doubt.
They've got this like cloning machine of guys who can throw gas for 2+ innings. And it's really remarkable. If they can get a lead to the bullpen, then their chance of winning goes up big time. So that's the other kind of interesting element there. I had a kind of sense going into this series, I thought, man, the Dodgers are going to win this thing in 6, and it might not take that long. After that first game, I thought, yeah, they're going to sweep this thing. But, you know, the Rays, to their credit, are resilient. They bounce back. They're going to have heroes emerge offensively. That's going to be the secret for them. They're going to have to get leads to the bullpen. But in order to get there, they've got to have some guys beat the Dodgers that aren't Randy, because the Dodgers are doing exactly the right thing. The same thing that we saw the Cardinals try to do against Fernando Tatis Jr. late in that series, where they just don't let him be who beats you. Make someone else do it. And if they do that, then you tip your cap, and that's a good game plan, you know, execution counter. But don't let this guy who's turned the postseason into a breakout performance just continue to do that against you. Give him pitches that are hard to hit, make him earn it, and don't be afraid to walk them. And you know, the numbers are there, though. What the Rays do without Randy Arozarena, they're a very meager hitting team.
Yep.
So make you know, compete against that team and take Randy out of it. I think that's the right approach. And I think over a 7-game series, that will reward the Dodgers. I still think they're going to win it, but it has gotten a little more interesting. So credit the Rays for making it a better series. It's fun to watch these two teams because of the storylines, right? I mean, one is the cost conscious new wave of baseball, value is everything. And the other is kind of the throwback, hey, spin to win. And we're going to see which one claims it. But I tell you what, it's fun to watch Mookie Betts play at this level with all the ways that he can affect the game. I mean, in his base running, in his defense, we saw the power show up in game 1. He's an incredibly fun player to watch. And I'd be okay if this series was 30 games if he gets to play like that every night.
He's incredible. I want to switch gears talk a little college football. We've got the Big Ten kicking off, so the Fighting Illini. We've got Mizzou and Kentucky tomorrow, and let's start with Mizzou and Kentucky. Kentucky, you know, they go to Tennessee. They knock off a very good Volunteers team, in my opinion, but they go to Knoxville and do it. So they're going to come to Columbia tomorrow. And Eli Drinkwitz, it's been a couple of weekends since we've had that LSU upset win. How do you size up this game?
Well, it's interesting because Missouri went from riding that high of that LSU upset to thinking it was going to go play Vanderbilt to thinking it was going to play Florida at Florida to thinking, oh, no, we got to get ready for Kentucky. And it's a Kentucky team that kind of stumbled out of the gate but is now playing very good football with back-to-back wins. That was a throttling they put on the Volunteers in Knoxville last week. They're a really solid program. They never get the respect they deserve, and people don't talk about this enough. They have this week, but leading into this, Missouri has lost to Kentucky now 5 consecutive years, Dan. I remember talking to you about this last year, and it's just gotten worse since then. There is not a player on this campus that knows what it's like to beat Kentucky in football. Vice versa. There's not a player in those meeting rooms in Lexington that knows what it's like to lose to Missouri. Now, the games have been close. Of course, one of them being the painful, you know, untimed down on a pass interference call in Columbia, 15-14, I believe was the score of that one, where Jim Sterk got caught cursing on the sideline after the game. I mean, they've been some painful losses, but there's really a dividing line in the SEC East. And, you know, what everyone says is that you're either a team that beats Kentucky or you're not. Well, but no one acknowledges that Mark Stoops has, to his credit, moved that line up. Kentucky is now the team that wouldn't lose to Kentucky, if that makes sense. You know, and they can point to that winning streak over Mizzou and say that. They're not flashy. They're not going to beat you with their big-armed quarterback. Terry Wilson would rather run it as much as he'd throw it, but they run the ball. They're dedicated to the run. They're averaging something like around 5 yards a carry, which is, do that twice, that's a first down. I'm not good at math, but I do know that if you round up. And then you also have a defense that's playing lights out. They're creating turnovers. They're taking picks back for touchdowns. Missouri's not going to be able to score, to have to hope to score 50 points in this game to win. They need to play good defense against Kentucky's run game, and they need to force Kentucky to try to beat them through the air, because I think they will have more success with that. They did a great job against the run against LSU, but LSU also didn't try to run it in the first half at all, and Kentucky certainly will. So that's, I think, is going to be the key to this game. And if Eli Drinkwitz can beat Kentucky and snap this streak, it will not be celebrated like the win against LSU was, but it might actually be a more quality win by the end of the season.
Yeah, you're right. And so Lovie Smith and the Illini and the Big Ten, they're back in action as the Fighting Illini and the Big Ten. They've got 8 straight weeks, no off weeks. So SEC, they built in some off weeks, even the championship game. If you're not in it, they could play in that. So if you do have a team that's hit with COVID, there's a chance then to maybe slip in a bye week and you could play there or play in the championship weekend, those kind of things. The Big Ten, the testing is every day. The Illini, you know, they're testing a couple of times a day with saliva tests and whatnot. They've really been at the forefront of the Big Ten. They've got Wisconsin tonight. Just give me your thoughts on how the Big Ten is trying to do this, and then dovetail into what you think is going on with Lovie Smith and the Fighting Illini.
Well, I think the Big Ten is smart to test every day across the board. I do think they made a mistake by not starting early enough that they can include any wiggle room weeks into their schedule in case a team has a setback. They have a very strict rule in place about the number of players on a team that can be that can have a positive test before they have to not play that week. And if they get to that number, then they're going to wish they would have scheduled in some bye week so they could do what we've seen the SEC do, which is kind of rewrite the schedule on the fly. So many things are going to have to go right for the Big Ten teams to have to avoid missing any of their games. You know, they're planning on playing 8 games, but there's no chance to make that up. And I think that could be a real problem if you're talking about Ohio State and its resume to make the college football playoff, or maybe like an undefeated surprise Big Ten team, say Minnesota, everybody's in love with Minnesota's chances this year. If they play limited to like 6 games, but they're undefeated, then how does that weigh against maybe a one loss Georgia team? And you can see how that conversation is just going to get chaotic. And in part because there's no wiggle room baked into this Big Ten schedule. So hopefully the everyday testing works, and hopefully this becomes a non-issue, although I'm afraid it will become a problem at some point. As for Illinois, interesting year, right? I mean, they had the kind of the high watermark last season, where they were able to really, you know, send Lovie Smith into the promising in that discussion about, hey, is his job on the line? They had that huge win at Michigan State. It came after they had beaten Wisconsin, a ranked Wisconsin team. It was four wins in a row. And then the worm turned on them a little bit. They lost that following week to Iowa. Okay, that was a ranked Iowa team. Then they lost to Northwestern. Then they went off and lost their bowl game. And it was three consecutive losses to end the season that kind of soured things a little bit. Not all of it, but a little bit. So that was frustrating, and now they have to – I think the thing is you'd really like to see them have a winning season. You'd like to see, you know, any of that hot seat conversation talk about Lovie Smith return. Illinois is in a fascinating place because they've got a coach that they extended and they have all this confidence in. They also have this financial climate that we're going to see where if you have a fresh coach off a fresh extension with a big buyout in play, then you're going to be less likely to move on. So – the best case for Illinois would be to keep people from wondering about Lovie's future there.
Hey, my man, awesome stuff. Should be a fun weekend. A lot of college football. Illini, Mizzou all in action. Got the World Series. And let's just keep it going and make sure you stay safe and healthy, and we'll catch you up next Friday.
Sounds good, brother. Talk to you soon. Have a good weekend, and we'll catch up in a week.
And if anybody would like to hear the Mike Shildt interview, that's up on the website. And wherever you get your podcast, give us a positive rating. And also, you can tweet at us as well. We appreciate Ben Friday. We do this every Friday on Scoops with DannyMac.com.